I remember a couple of years ago being at the Accounting Excellence Awards, and anyone who's been to those awards or knows anything about the industry will know that the Outstanding Contribution Award is the biggest and best award. There is no nominations, it gets awarded at the end of the night, and it is always a complete surprise. So a couple of years ago now, I was sat in the crowd, and the name that got called when this award was announced was the one and only Lucy Cohen. Winning this award was actually a surprise to Lucy herself, and it was the result of having some really difficult, honest conversations with the accounting industry over COVID and sharing all those thoughts on LinkedIn. Lucy has built one of the biggest female-owned accountancy firms in the world. She is a best-selling author, winner of the Short Book Awards, and Lucy actually built the first ever subscription model accountancy firm. She invented the concept, and we know and love this model today. Lucy has some ruthless principles in the way that she governs her firm, and she tells us everything in this episode. And on top of all that, Lucy is just such a force of nature. Just being around her will lift you up. Welcome to this episode of Firm Up with Lucy Cohen, where we'll give you all the mindsets and practical tips to build an exceptional firm. Enjoy. Lucy, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So the first thing I'm going to say about you is at any conference, award ceremony, or any industry event I've ever been to, you have always been the person that stands out from the crowd.
Oh God, no, why?
In the best way. Why do you think?
Oh, I don't, do you know what? I don't know. I do get that a lot though. And I think it's maybe for a few reasons. I look quite unusual. Like my whole general look is quite unusual. I spent a lot of my life knowing that I don't look like everybody else. And I think that as I've got older, and not necessarily older, but I suppose had more life experience, I just care less about what people think about me. So I'm very happy to like wear the ridiculous outfit, or just kind of, I'm just really happy being me. And I've reached a stage in my life probably a while ago where I'm like, I'm not going to be for everybody. And in fact, if I was for everybody, then that's just being like Magnolia Paint, isn't it? Like no one wants that. So I'm just quite happy being who I am. And if you don't vibe with it, that's cool. But if you do, that's even better. And yeah. I think that's maybe why, maybe. I don't know.
Absolutely. I remember it was the Accounting Excellence Awards. I want to say 2019, but I can't remember if it was before or after COVID. Either way, it was the year that you won the...
Oh, 2021 that was.
2021.
Yeah.
God. Is that... Yeah. 2021. And you wore the most incredible, like, red...
Oh, the red tulle dress.
Yes.
Yeah, with the biker boots.
Yes.
Yeah, I love a bit of tulle.
Yeah.
I do love tulle.
And at an accounting event, I think at any event you would stand out, but at an event full of accountants who generally the stereotype is rather introverted and kind of wear the thing that makes them fit in as much as possible, you really stand out. Where does that come from in your, like, upbringing? Do you have, like, a creative...
Yeah, my family are all performers. So my background is I come from a very, very creative family. So my big rebellion in life was like training to be an accountant, like getting a proper job, because everyone is an actor, a dancer, a musician, an artist, a concert pianist, composers. You know, they're all performers. And in fact, I used to want to be a dancer. So I spent my childhood and my teens dancing, acting. So I think maybe it comes from that. I'm not, it's not that I want to draw attention to myself. It's more that I'm not scared to wear the thing or say the thing that is just authentically how I feel in that moment. So it's not dressing for attention's sake, because that's not quite it, because I'm super, I think if you do that just for kind of eyeballs, you're probably not very comfortable in what you're wearing. You probably don't feel like you. I tend to like to kind of present myself in a way that's authentically me, and I think that is just not very conventional generally.
So what was your route into accounting then?
Yeah, I took a bit of a circuitous route into accounting. So I had wanted to be in front of the camera, and then that didn't kind of pan out originally, well, until now, obviously. This is the route into clearly fame and fortune, and Hollywood will be knocking any moment, I'm sure. But didn't work out in front of the camera, so thought, well, I'll go and train to be behind the camera. And I got into university to study drama. For whatever reason, that year I couldn't go. Some things came up, so I took a gap year. And me being me was like, oh, well, I'll go and see if the thing I want to do, I like doing. I managed to kind of blag my way into working onto a couple of films. So I did that for about 18 months and absolutely hated it, just hated it, because I was working as a stand-in, as a runner, as a dance double, and you just spend kind of 11 hours a day, 6 days a week in a wet field, and it just wasn't the life for me. So at the grand old age of, I think I was about 20, I realised that the university course I was about to get into a lot of debt on wasn't probably the route I wanted to take in life. So I went into Cardiff City Centre at the time, and there was a careers office there. So I went into the careers office and just said, look, I don't know what I want to do. I'm 20. I'm smart. I'm pretty academic. What should I do? And they got out what I can only assume is an alphabetical list of careers and went, accountancy. I was like, done. Sold. That sounds good. I can be in an office and not in a wet field. So I walked across the road to what was Jury's Hotel Group at the time and walked in, and there was a woman behind the reception desk who happened to be the financial controller of the hotel. And I said, do you have any jobs and accounts? And she went, that's weird. Our purchase ledger clerk has just left. And I was like, great. I didn't know what that was. And she went, can you do purchase ledger? I was like, yeah, probably. Yeah, why not? And she's like, okay, great. Start on Monday. Essentially, that was it. And that's how I got into it. That's how I got my first job in accounts. I started studying the AAT part-time in college. And that was how I got into accountancy and kind of fell in love with it. Fell in love with the, it's ordered, you get to, you know, not stand in a wet field usually. And it gives you the insights into a business in a way that I think other things don't. And I just kind of fell in love with the whole thing and the opportunities it gave. And that was how I first got into it. And then the inspiration for Mazooma came about because I saw my family being creatives, being amazing at what they did, but absolutely horrible at finance and the tax returns. And I saw that really poor relationship they had with the kind of very traditional accountants that you had at the time. And that's what inspired me to start Mazooma, was to solve a problem for them. And that's really how it all came about.
Amazing. Not many people would have the confidence to just go, yeah, I can do purchase ledger accounts.
Yeah, I've always been weirdly confident. I think it's a lifetime as a child growing up on a stage and being around people who just encouraged you to go and be you. And I think as well, I've talked a little bit about this when I talk quite a lot about getting out of your own way, in that when you grow up in a family where you work in the arts and where everyone's in the arts, income isn't necessarily guaranteed, but also failure's just par for the course. You do an audition, you don't get the part, you move on, maybe three or four times in one day. It's just part of it. So to go and ask for the thing and do the thing and not be scared of being rejected, I think empowers you to, well, what do you have to lose in that moment? I had nothing to lose at that point in time, nothing. What would they have said? No. And I'd gone, oh, well, and I would be on to the next thing. I think it was a very empowering environment in that way. And I just learned that you're going to get loads of knockbacks, but it's not about those, it's about the times that you do succeed, which are far fewer, but more important.
It's incredible. So Mazooma, just share a bit about, because it's an incredibly successful firm. You have ran it for 17 years. Just share us some stats, like give us an overview of where you're at today.
So I'll start from, I suppose I'll do a brief kind of synopsis. So we founded in 2006, mm-hmm. Which is sort of the crustaceous period compared to technology nowadays. And it was kind of pre-cloud accounting. Everything was kind of still very desktop based. And it was the first ever subscription service in accountancy, which is quite a common business model now, but we were the first people ever to do it. The first business advisor I saw told me it was a horrible idea.
And what do you mean? Just what do you mean by subscription service?
So people pay a subscription, like Netflix for accounts.
Yeah, okay. So like a monthly fee.
Yeah, and everything's included. So it involves us having to work to very strict margins, very kind of prescriptive way of working. We started that in 2006 with literally fill up a purple envelope with your receipts and we'll do everything else. And it's evolved from there. So now we've developed our own technology. We're a multi-million pound company. We're growing really rapidly at the moment. And we're one of the largest providers across the UK of this style of service.
It's amazing. And Mazooma, like some things that really stand out that we've spoke about before is like your very, I'm going to say cutthroat in the best way, methods of dealing with clients.
Yeah.
And the ways that you deal with clients are some that I think a lot of other accountancy firms need and would take a lot from if they could just deploy a few of these. So just give us a bit of an overview of that.
Yeah. So because we because it's a subscription model, so everything's bundled in. And yeah, there are different kind of levels of subscription, but ultimately, because everything is bundled in order for us to make our margins work, we have to be really ruthless in the way we deliver service. We basically have a manufacturing business model applied to a service-based industry. If anyone knows anything about manufacturing, they quite often use something called Lean Six Sigma. We very much adopt those approaches to it. We need things to move from A to B to C and out the door in a strict time frame. We know all kinds of stats about our clients. We know how many transactions on average they have per month. We know all that sort of data, and we work on averages. So yes, some of them we make a lot of profit off, some of them we don't, but it all averages out. And that's the model, really. It's about taking it from A to B to C in as few clicks or in as few moves as possible. To do that, we have to be very strict around things like service level agreements. So clients will only get, depending on their package, X number of minutes per month on the phone to you, for example. We measure that, we monitor it, and if people go over it, we take action. And that's I think by industry standards, really, like you said, I'm perfectly comfortable with the word ruthless and cutthroat, because it has to be, because you don't make profits by being nice a lot of the time. You have to adopt quite a hard stance on things. And it doesn't mean your service can't be friendly, it can't be personable, it can't be, exactly what the client needs. But it means that you have to deliver it in a way, knowing that ultimately what you're doing is protecting your stakeholders, which is your staff, yourselves, shareholders, bottom line, all that stuff. In order to make the best decision for the good of the company, you have to be able to adopt those strategies. So yeah, we data is what we're all about. And we measure everything, we test everything. And it's always about making those tiny improvements. Can we shave 30 seconds per client per month off? Here translates into hundreds of hours of time saving and ultimately profit for us. So that's kind of how we operate, which is, I think, a really alien way to work in this space.
But it's incredible. So the A to B to C, what does that actually look like?
So it's all from, we're quite unique in that we don't get our clients to do any sort of data entry. So we do all that for them, because for the sorts of clients we work with, asking them to do their own data entry or bank reconciliations, it is a nightmare. We'd spend more time on picking it. It's quicker just to do it ourselves. And they're not the sort of client base that are open to being educated on how to do that. They just don't want to do it. And that's fine. We're built for them. So it's about getting their raw data, which might be still physical envelopes. About 14% of our client base still physically send in physical paperwork. It's about getting that into the system. It's about getting the data off that paperwork. It's about hooking it up with bank feeds. It's about getting that data analysed and in front of an accountant's eyes as quickly as possible, only working with exceptions, making sets of rules to follow, and then only having to make decisions in the moment on exceptions, QAing it and getting it out the door again. So if you think about it as a production line, putting things together, that's what we're doing over and over and over again. And we make our money when we do the same thing well, repeatedly.
Yeah. What happens when someone misses a deadline?
We don't miss deadlines because of this, but deadlines do get missed.
By clients.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tough, really. They're warned. They are told the parameters. We're very big on setting boundaries. We have it in all our T's and C's about when they have to get things to us relative to their year ends. They get reminded plenty of times. If they then don't do it, it is very much we'll try our best, but we're making no guarantees to this. And any fines, penalties are very much your own responsibility. Clients for whom that does happen, it typically only ever happens once.
Yeah. I think a lot of accountancy firms are almost scared of their clients because it's their income source.
Yes.
Do you think this flips the accountability switch?
Yeah, because ultimately it is the client that's accountable. Mm. It's their business. Yes, we're running our businesses and we have a duty to make sure we're looking after clients and being professional and advising them in the right way. But ultimately, they are responsible for the financial health of their own businesses. If they can't take accountability, or we can't train them to take accountability for their own deadlines, that is kind of their own problem. And I think that that's a really important message there. You wouldn't get it in other professions. You wouldn't get lawyers going, oh, well, I'm going to mollycoddle you through this process. If you haven't provided this stuff to them by the date they want it, then tough, they've got other clients. I do think we, as a profession, as a collective, tend to act as if our clients have more power over us than they do. I think that relationship goes two ways, and it's an adult relationship. It's not parent child, And I think sometimes we look at it like that. I think it's an adult-adult relationship. You're all professionals. It's a professional relationship with terms and conditions. And those terms and conditions very naturally within them have boundaries. And everyone needs to stick to those so that you know what's expected of each other.
What does your day look like? How involved are you?
So I tend to sit more on the commercial side of the business. So I will oversee the sales teams, marketing, brand strategy, that sort of thing. My business partner, Sophie, sits more on the operations and tech side of things. So she'll oversee kind of the strategic elements of that. We have a management team in though. So it's been a long time since I've done a tax return. Please don't ask me to do one because I don't think I could anymore. but yeah, in that sense. So I think I have I've got four direct reports to me and then they work with the wider team.
You must be, and I don't know the stats on this, I have no stat to back this up, but I get the feeling, you must be one of the biggest female-owned accountancy firm owners, at least in the UK, if not.
Yes.
Much bigger than that.
Yeah, we are, yeah.
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 I know that feminism is really, really important to you.
Yes.
Where have those things, like, overlapped? What have you experienced in your career that's meant feminism is more important than ever?
Yeah, feminism, hugely important to me, and I think my journey into it, I've been in this space for, I'm 40 now. I founded Mazooma when I was 23. So I was young and a moron and very confident in doing it. But it's been a really interesting journey. So I went to a girls' school, which this is going to sound really strange, but I don't think I really like realised I was a woman until other people started telling me I was, if that makes any sense at all. And that was as an adult in the professional space. So I went to a girls' school where obviously you don't have any kind of like there's no gender dynamics because you're all girls. You're just focusing on doing your work. Most of my friendship group were female because of that. I also was in dance. So that's a very kind of female space. And it wasn't really until I went out on my own as an accountant and was suddenly in a very male dominated space that I started noticing that I was being treated differently. I would go to networking events and people would ask me, is it your dad's company? And or they'd ask me, like, am I the receptionist? Do I work in, you know, am I a PA? And that was for two reasons. Firstly, I was young, I was 23, still not right, but that didn't help. And I was a woman. And it took I was in denial about it for a long time. And I was like, no, it's not that. It's just, you know, why wouldn't you assume that? And then I started realizing, no, I am treated differently because I'm a woman. And once it's switched on and once you see it, you can't unsee it and you become kind of hyper-vigilant to it, I suppose. And then you start seeing it everywhere and it's been baked into what we do as a company. You know, we have very strong female leadership at Mazooma. I think partly because we started giving opportunities to women who wanted to balance work and life way before other companies did. Most of our management team came in with childcare responsibilities or caring responsibilities for relatives. And as we know in the workforce currently, as we're recording this, 70% of those still fall to women, even if they work full time. Child and elder care tends to fall to women in society. So we gave women the opportunity to work flexibly around that. And I think that built a strong leadership team of women within there. I do get feedback from the team that they really like that they have strong female leadership. I know that certainly a couple of our team have said it's one of the reasons they chose to work for us over somebody else because they felt like that was a really good thing. But yeah, feminism is hugely important to me. I'm so pleased that as a kind of an industry, we're moving. I'm not delighted at the pace of change, which is glacial, I think, at times. But I am so there for the fight. I'm so there for it.
Yeah, and I think we all felt that when you stepped on that stage in the bright red tool dress.
Yeah, I'm ready for it.
Yeah. So talk to me about that award, because you didn't know you were going to win that.
No.
And it's an emotional award to anyone who's been to Accountant Excellence. The final, it's the outstanding contribution. It's not nominated. You don't have a judging panel. Nobody's got any clue who it's going to be.
No.
And it is, for lack of a better phrase, like the don of the industry in that year. The person who has contributed the most to moving the industry forward. Has just been doing incredible things. And you were recognised for that.
Yeah. So I'd had a really, really crappy 18 months or so at the point that I won that award. It'd been about 9 months when I won that. I'd had a really, really rubbish year. So not only had we come out of the back of the pandemic, But I was really ill, which I'll go into in a little bit. So I had no idea I was going to win that award. I knew that I was shortlisted for Practice Pioneer. And I honestly thought that those awards were like a stitch up. Like, I thought that you always knew it was going to be you, so you could like put on your face or whatever else. And I genuinely had no idea I was going to win it, because usually it goes to somebody who's been around a lot longer than I have.
A lot old, yes.
Yeah. It's like a lifetime achievement award. So it wasn't kind of even in my head that was a thing. And I knew that I was up for Practice Pioneer and I got highly commended for that. I was like, awesome. That's great. I was like super chuffed with that. And they do like a little preamble about who it's going to be. And if you've ever been there, they talk very broadly about who this person is. And then it starts kind of narrowing down. And I started listening. Oh, that person sounds interesting. I wonder who that is. And then it started getting narrower and narrower. I was like, hang on a second. That sounds a bit like me. And then I was kind of going through the thing. I was like, no. Like that, no, that's not it. Like, shut up, Lucy. And then it became really, really apparent it was me. And I was like, oh my God, like, what is happening? And it was really emotional because I've talked very openly about some of my mental health challenges. So I'm an anxiety sufferer. I can catastrophize anything into a complete disaster instantaneously. It's a real talent. I'm great at it. But I also suffer with depression for a year. And I wrote an article for Accounting Web. I wrote two, I think, quite hard-hitting articles. I wrote one about having depression for a year, how I handled it and how I was treated for it. And that article, I've never had such a response to it. I still get messages today. Every week I get maybe five messages from people saying they've just come across that article for the first time and they're so glad someone's talking about it. They had depression for a bit too, or they're still struggling with it or whatever it is. I also get a lot, oh, but you'd never think that somebody like you would suffer. And I still find that stigma and stereotype galling. It's quite a jarring thing to hear, because that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to go, not in a big-headed way, but if you look at, say, my social media or lists of whatever, you only ever list out your successful stuff, right? I look quite successful. But underneath that, there's a lot of failure and there's a lot of, really dark, dark days. And I wanted to sort of normalise that process. So I spoke really openly about that. And then very inconveniently in April 2021, I very dramatically nearly died of some blood clots. So that was quite dramatic at the time. And my consultant had said to me when it happened, for those that hadn't read the article, don't know the story, I was out walking the dog. My right leg just like cramped up and I couldn't walk and I was in a lot of pain. I thought I'd ripped something, like a tendon or, my hamstring or something. I went to the osteopath. My foot had like gone blue and he was like, oh, I think you should go to the doctors. Went to the doctors and they were like, well, we're not really worried because you're young and you're fit and you're healthy, so it's probably nothing. And then fast forward to some days in hospital, every test under the sun, and a white-faced consultant who said to me, I don't normally get to speak to people who've had this happen to them because they're usually dead. And I was like, cool.
Oh my.
And he was like, yeah. So we don't really know what to do with you. We don't know what caused it. There's nothing wrong with you. But I had 17 arterial blood clots that landed mainly in my right leg. So I had to learn to walk again. I was very ill. I obviously was in massive denial about how ill I was. Just carried on running a business through a pandemic. But that was quite a life-changing moment, because in that moment, it would have been, I suppose, those are the sort of moments where you have that kind of like close call. A lot of people would have gone, right, I'm going to change everything about my life. Like, I'm quitting what I do. I'm traveling the world. I'm leaving my partner. I'm, whatever it's going to be. I'm going to shave my head and join a commune, whatever. I'm not going to rule that out, by the way.
I was going to say that. Yeah,
fairly on brand for me. I didn't. In that moment, I was suddenly really grateful and proud of what I'd achieved. And I remember thinking, do you know what? If I had died, if that had been it, because they had said to me, like, had one of those blood clots gone anywhere else, I literally would have just dropped dead on the spot. Like, just that would have been it. I'd have been a statistic. I'd been one of those, like, oh. And she was just like walking the dog and dropped dead. It could happen to anyone. That would have been me. That would have been the end of my story. And I kind of thought, well, if I had dropped dead in that moment, like that, I could have looked at my life and gone, yeah, I was really proud of that. I did a really good job. I showed up as myself. I always had a purpose and I always gave everything my all. Like I tried. And then the other part of it went,
but I can do so much more. And it suddenly became quite a liberating experience, this thing of, yeah, do you know what? Not even that killed me. So what have you got, world? What else can we do? And I think that kind of the anxiety that I still suffer from, and I can kind of laugh about it because I know it's not real. Like, just because you think something in your head doesn't mean it's true. So I can kind of laugh at my own anxiety. But of all the things I've catastrophized in my life, I never thought of that ever happening. So it just sort of proved to me that anxiety, if anyone does suffer from it, is a massive liar. It lies to you all the time. Because the bad thing that does happen, you'll never have thought of,
yeah,
ever. But also, you can survive it. Like, there's literally nothing that you've not survived so far. That's it. So knowing all that and all that data and all that proof you have about your abilities, why wouldn't you just go and try and smash it? So that you kind of lifted that. And I wrote about that again. And I was really public about it. And I spoke about it in a profession and a space where I think people can be a little bit kind of guarded about their experiences and their feelings. And again, just a huge kind of outpouring from the community. That was kind of, I think, the basis of why I won the award that year.
It's a thankless job being the boss, isn't it?
No one cares about the boss.
Exactly.
No one cares.
It's a very thankless job. In that you are like any manager employee relationship is it's a one way street. Mm. You give them the support, you pay them, you train them.
Yeah.
It's a very one way street. Do you think business ownership has led to the depression, led to you feeling anxious?
I think I'm when I look back, so I'm a big advocate of therapy. So I go to therapy. When I look back, I've always had a degree of anxiousness about me. I was an anxious child. I'm a type A type person. I'm a high achiever. Those things very often go hand in hand. I also went to a very academically competitive school, which I think if you are that kind of person, you probably like do incredibly well in and would be seen to be thriving academically, but maybe it's not the best for your mental health. You know, and I was in school in the 90s, you know, there wasn't a lot of meditation and yoga in the curriculum back then. Certainly not the school I went to. But I think that on one hand, yeah, you can let it get to you. So if you're not someone who can build resilience or has it naturally, you're saying all those things. I'm an incredibly resilient person and I'm quite thick-skinned kind of naturally. But even then, it's still a skill you have to hone. Like it doesn't come naturally for people to complain about the business you built. They're working in it and you've given everything and you get complaints. So you just have to remember not to take it personally. If you let that get to you, or if you choose to let it in or not process it properly, it could definitely contribute to the anxiety, to depression. I think as well, just the constant downward pressure of always having all decisions riding on your shoulders. So like, you know, when you get days when like you can't even decide what to have for dinner, like when you're at full burnout. I've talked about burnout before, and if I'm in the stage of burnout, like I'll give myself a uniform just so I don't have to think about what to wear every day, like black leggings, black top. That'll be, you see me in that for 6 weeks on end, you know what's happening. Like, but it's because I don't want to think about other stuff. I think that if you don't know how to manage that, you could let that get on top of you. And it's having the support networks around you. And that might not be your friends and family, because often they don't know what running a business is like. It's really hard to relate to. It's definitely not your team and your staff, because they're your employees, and you might get on really well with them, but they're not your friends. And so it's finding other business owners, it's finding communities, it's finding places to be around people who do understand what you're going through. I think that's kind of how you counter it. It's constant downward pressure, and it's kind of accepting a life of knowing the buck always stops with you, and learning how to be okay with that and how to let that go sometimes. And I think a little bit kind of trusting that the universe probably doesn't throw stuff at you that you can't handle. So you learn. I quite often talk about, I always wish I had my problems from 3 years ago, like, because at the time they felt huge. Now I'm like, I'd love that problem now. It's so easy. But that's, I've said before, you win or you learn. Like that's literally it. It's all a journey.
Yeah. It's an amazing mindset to have. Do you think the industry, because you just said, get amazing business owners around you, and obviously from an outsider's perspective of accountancy business owners, that would make a lot of sense for everyone to group together.
Mm.
Do you think people stop themselves doing that because there's a lot of competition?
So I think when we started out, so back in 2006, it was very much kind of what I call scarcity mindset, like someone else's success meant your failure. And you couldn't fathom the idea of two people being successful in the same space at the same time. And a lot of certainly local accountants felt very threatened by us when we started. I could tell some stories about that. And it was that was really hard because I'd not only had like business advisors tell me it was a horrible idea, but also other people within the accounting space weren't that welcoming to us. But over the years, that has so much changed. Like you do get communities now. You do get firm owners recognizing that you work in different niches, or you work in different markets, or your ideal client looks slightly different, or you deliver service in a slightly different way. That means that there is much more community than there used to be. I think people probably, maybe wisely, there's obviously commercial sensitivity to your secret sauce. So maybe like don't go giving all that out. But it doesn't mean you can't be there to be empathetic to another business owner going through probably really similar problems. And the problems don't change the bigger you get. They've just got more zeros on them. That's all it is. It's always people, cash flow, process, growth. It's all the same stuff. So I kind of, when people say to me like, oh, you don't want to hear about my problems because you've got much bigger problems. I'm like, they're the same problems. Can't recruit the right people. Training doesn't stick, et cetera, et cetera. It's all the same thing. So I think sharing that makes you feel like you're not going mad. Sometimes you think some of the stories I've got, you're there thinking like, this can't be happening to other people. Like, what is going on here? Are we cursed? Then you talk to other business owners and you're like, nope, everyone has this. This is the same thing everywhere. And there's something quite like nice about that. You're like, thank goodness it's not just me.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah.
It's that amazing realization that you're not the only one who feels like this.
Yeah. We've all got stories of terrible staff and horrible hires and nightmare clients and all that. Like, everyone's got them. You should share them because they're hilarious when you share them together.
Yeah. You must have seen some big... Because you... Not only have you got a firm that's quite well established, you've been going for 17 years, but you're a lot of firms that are that well established and have been running for that amount of time are a bit behind.
Mm-hmm.
They're not growing, they're not changing, not adapting. They're getting left behind. But you're not. You must have been through some massive changes through cloud adoption, through COVID, through...
Yeah, so, I mean, that's always been what we do, though. Like when we started... The concept of put it in a purple envelope and send it to us and we do everything else was just, it sounds so simple now, but at the time it just blew people's minds.
Innovation.
Yeah, it was this idea of, well, you can't do that. And I was like, well, why not? Like, why can't we do this? So that's very much always been at our core. And I'm always a big believer in trying to stay ahead of that curve because once you are an innovator, the trick is staying there. Like, you don't want to become the incumbent. Like, you don't want to be Kodak and not see the digital revolution coming. So we've always been ahead of the curve, but always very clear that I hate change for change's sake. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not going to go and redesign something just for a laugh, just because I like want to change it. It has to have a purpose because we've always, historically, we've always bootstrapped. So we've not had the luxury of being able to A/B split test expensive campaigns or anything like that. It's always been... We don't have an advertising budget. We have an ROI and we have to make sure every penny we spend returns to us. So because of that, innovation kind of sits right in the middle of that in that, right, we don't have very much. What can we do with what we do have though? So, all right, we can't afford this thing, but what's the purpose of this? What's the purpose of this advertising campaign? Say it's to get in front of this number of eyes and get those people to convert into clients. Okay, well, we think that a good campaign might do that and it would result in, I don't know, 100 clients. How else could we get 100 clients with a different marketing strategy? What else could we do? And it breeds creativity. It forces you to think outside the box.
Yeah.
And so because that's always been like at the heart of what we do, we've managed to stay ahead of the curve. And it just means that we've seen change, but we've also been part of change.
Yeah.
So that adoption of a subscription fixed fee model, we very much kind of were pioneering of that back in the day. That's really commonplace now. I think there's lots of things that we're starting to see adopted, which will become kind of commonplace as we go forward. We are early adopters of technology. We do like to trial things and test them, and then we keep what works. But I think that I don't like the idea. I also come from a place of gratitude in that, and with gratitude, I think comes a recognition that you can't rest on your laurels. Mm-hmm. So I'm grateful to where we've got to. And every day I'm really grateful for the challenges. And because of that, I'm like, you can't relax. Like, you can't just go, we're done now. You're like, okay, what's next?
Yeah.
And that's just, I think it's just in all of us who work at Mazooma.
I love it. I like to call those things positive constraints.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Yeah. I feel like we had it a lot at Go Proposal because we were bootstrapped, one of the only SaaS companies to exist that didn't have investment because we wanted to stay in control of what we were doing as opposed to giving away a chunk of the business. And it forced positive constraints. It forced us to be more creative with what we had. We couldn't afford to just throw money at problems, but we had the problems. Mm-hmm. We had to fix them, but we couldn't throw money at it. And it forces everyone to go into this like gritty, let's fight our way out of this hole mode.
Yeah.
And you can get the best innovation and creativity comes from those modes.
Yeah, and it's a really hard mode to work in all the time because it's tiring.
Yeah.
Like, you can't be intellectually lazy and just go, oh, well, we'll just pay someone to do that.
Put it on an ad.
You go, yeah. You can't do that. You have to think really creatively. But I think as well, I'm a big believer in growth mindset and that you change your intelligence and your capabilities. You can learn. I don't think those are fixed at all. I think they grow and develop as you go through life experiences. Like, there's nothing better for a growth mindset than having to constantly problem solve. Just your abilities, your development as a leader in doing that are just exponential compared to if you just sat in a job where you were allowed to blow money on budgets. And not only that, but there are no consequences. Like, the consequences of doing it in a scrappy organization are that you don't get the growth and then people don't get pay rises. Or like, you're on the breadline and you're thinking, how am I going to make payroll? Like, that's the very real consequence of that. But it makes you sharp as hell. And yeah, that's something that even as we've grown and we have had more budget for things, we're always very much like, no, what's the return on this? Like, why would we do this? Tell me why we do it. Why is this better than kind of just thinking a bit more creatively about it?
Yeah. Rachel Harris on a previous episode told me two things about you.
Oh no. What she said.
But she said she was talking about all the brilliant people in her life and things that they've got in common. And two of them shit about you. One of them was your ability to, even though you are at the top of your game, doing incredibly well, you still seek advice and help.
Yeah.
You're constantly looking to like learn and from other people and grow and change. And the other thing she mentioned was being in elite sports.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'll go for the growing and changing one first. I don't want to be the smartest person in the room, like, ever. I really, I'm quite masochistic, actually. So when we've got a board now and one of my board members asked me, what do you want from me? And I was like, don't be nice to me. I was like, I'm a big girl. Like, I don't want you to mollycoddle me. If you think I'm doing a shit job, you tell me and you tell me directly. And I might go and sulk about it for a bit, but I'm going to get over it and come back better. Like, that's what you do with me. Like, I need that challenge. And also, I think, again, back to like the being scrappy thing and creative, I feel like when the ride's easy, you get complacent. It's that phrase, isn't it? Like, smooth seas never made a good sailor. I feel like that. I feel like the adversity, the challenge. I remember going to a mastermind group once and I walked in and I sat around with these people and they were all talking in such easy depth about this topic. And I sat there, my mind was blown. I was like, I'm so thick compared to these people. I'm so stupid. And I was like, great.
That's why I want to be here.
Yeah, that's why I'm here, because I can learn something from all these people. And eventually, I'm also very like, I don't want to take more than I give. So I'm very much aware that when I get into those rooms at the start of it, I might not be able to give very much. I'm going to take a lot from people, but maybe I'll be able to be in a room where I can give that to other people at some point. So I like that kind of cyclical thing. And then the elite sport thing is I was on the British powerlifting team for a while.
Another iconic thing from you, just to add to the list.
Yeah, so I'm freakishly strong physically. And I really, the reason I found powerlifting such a good challenge for me, not just a physical thing. So first of all, I wanted to do something with my body that wasn't about what it looked like. As a woman in particular, I thought that was really important. I also thought it was like
pretty badass as well for a woman to be really physically strong. Like, I also thought that was really cool. Terminator 2, when she's doing kind of like chin-ups in her cell, I was like, that is like goals for me. Not the apocalypse bit, but the physical strength bit, maybe. And I'm always been, I'm articulate, I know that. I'm always quite confident that I could talk my way into or out of anything. And you can't do that with powerlifting. Like, you're either strong enough or you're not. So when you're on the platform and you're competing to a very specific set of standards, and you can either lift the weight or you can't on the day, there's no arguing with that. And so that was me being massively out of my comfort zone, because I had to go out and physically perform, and I couldn't like debate my way out of it. That was a really good challenge for me, and I really enjoyed it.
And you, but you say freakishly strong, like it just happened by accident, and I'm sure it didn't.
No, so there's obviously so when I was younger, I danced, I did a lot of sports, so I've always been athletic. I've always enjoyed using my body in an interesting way. Like, I think bodies are fascinating, and I think they can do all kinds of amazing things, and they can do a lot more than you. Your own body can do a lot more than you think it can. You can push yourself way beyond what is comfortable or what you think you could ever do. We see that all the time. People take on challenges, and the endeavors of the kind of human physicality, I think, are fascinating. So I've always enjoyed doing something physical. I'm not a runner. You ask me to run a marathon, I will not. Just if you say, would you like to enter this half marathon, Lucy? No, thank you. It's not for me. But the idea of picking weights up, becoming physically strong, was very appealing to me. I started seeing a PT. Turned out that I enjoyed the weights, and I was quite good at it. He just said, you should enter a competition. It's good to have a thing to train for.
Yeah.
I'm very competitive. I was like, great. Did that, won the competition, and there were some people from British Powerlifting around. It's like, oh, you should come and kind of do some more stuff. Obviously, the training for that's really hard. It's hard physically on your body. There are days when you just don't want to do it, but you have to. You've just got to kind of get through it. There's huge lessons in that. In some days when you don't want to do something, I used to tell myself, right, I don't have to go and do my full training session. I just have to drive to the gym. Just have to drive there. And then I'd get there, I'm like, well, I may as well just go through the door now. And then it's like, oh, I may as well just warm up now. And by the time you've got over it, you're like, I may as well just do the session, and you end up enjoying it. So I think there's something there in that mindset of just do the first bit. And if you still turn up and you don't want to do it, you have permission to go home again. But just do the first bit. Yeah. And I think that I take that into business as well. Like, this thing I don't want to do, just do the first 1% of it. Like, just do a bit, and you find yourself through it before you know. But yeah, really enjoyed training that. It's a demanding sport. You have to make weight categories. If you're on the British team, you'll have to travel internationally and deal with traveling on your own, deal with traveling not for a holiday, traveling with all your sports equipment and all that kind of stuff. But you get to be in a team. You get teammates. It's a great leveler of people, because yeah, everyone's got different backgrounds, but the thing you're all there for is this kind of shared love of lifting weights up. It was a great thing to be part of. And now, even though I don't lift competitively anymore, I still do the training. And I'm a nationally qualified referee, so I go and referee the sports and kind of give back in that way as well.
Amazing. And how does that impact your business?
The powerlifting?
Yeah.
I think it's... you have to have something outside of business. Otherwise, it's really easy to be consumed by it. Mm-hmm. And the last few months we've been through a really high growth phase, some really exciting challenges, but it has been a little bit all consuming. And I've been very honest with myself in the kind of last quarter of this year, is that I have let some of those things go. I've let the kind of self-care slip. I've let the training slip a bit. I've given myself permission to do that, because sometimes that's okay. But I have told myself that I will step back into it in the next couple of weeks, to make sure that I don't let that kind of part of my life slip. I think it gives you the lessons in business, the tenacity, the dedication, the doing the hard thing, even though you don't want to do the hard thing, the pushing yourself outside your comfort zone, being in a team of people you maybe haven't known before, and maybe might not choose to mix with always. Like, you meet people from all walks of life in business, you meet people from all walks of life when you're doing a sport. You have to learn to work with those people. They're not always going to have the same background and experiences as you, and they'll have different strengths and weaknesses to you. It's learning how to work with those. I just think that having something like that in your life that is not business, but there are so many lessons you can take into it, it's just it's just super valuable.
Yeah.
So if you can find anything, whatever it is, that teaches you that stuff and put it into a different context, yeah, it's really eye-opening.
Yeah, I agree. I like finding things that I can pour like intrinsic love into.
Yeah.
Because when running a business, whether it's you like in your career, you're developing, you can tell yourself that you do all these things for how it feels internally and blah, blah, blah. On the surface level, there is money and there is goal, there is KPIs, mm-hmm. and there's numbers attached to it. And I never know how much of my self-worth I attach to those.
Yeah.
And so when I find hobbies to pour love into, I think, but I know that there's nothing that torturing myself basically in a gym for an hour every single day, getting screamed at by a PT, there's nothing extrinsic that happens there because it's hard. It's like mm-hmm. really hard, and there's no extrinsic motivation. I suppose actually you could say the way your body looks.
The but endorphins, then, the fitness.
The endorphins, yeah. But the endorphins I'd say are intrinsic as well. But it's like finding something. I always have to find pockets of my life that I know no matter what, I'm doing it for the right reason. Because I can gaslight myself and saying, no, I'm running business for the right reason. It's my passion. It's, mm-hmm. I'm fulfilling my potential in life. I'm helping other people. But deep down, like, but if I didn't get paid, I wouldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
If it wasn't paying the bills and making sure that I could travel the world and do it, giving me the life I wanted, I probably wouldn't do it. So we need to find something else to make sure that you just connect in with that intrinsic part of yourself.
Yeah, and I think as well, depending on the sort of person you are, it's something I've talked to my therapist about, is that one of my kind of core things is I struggle with understanding my context if I don't have a use. So my use value, if I'm not kind of, if I'm not providing value, then why am I here? And I think that when you've got, like, I was a good powerlifter, but I wasn't like, I wasn't like world champion or anything. Like, I was globally a very mediocre powerlifter, and that was fine. Like, my use there wasn't winning the medals or anything. I was just a kind of, I was a B-side team member, like, for the numbers. And that was absolutely fine. And that's really freeing. If you're somebody who's really type A, who's very highly driven, who's very success-driven, who looks for feedback from people around you, you can see how you're creating value in a room. When you're in a place where you're not the best person there, and you know that you can't be because there's people from other countries who've literally been lifting weights since they were four, it's really freeing to be kind of, to do something and enjoy it and be relatively mediocre at it. Like, there's a great joy in that. Like, I absolutely love singing. I'm horrible at it, and I love a bit of karaoke, but it's great.
Yeah.
And it's nice to do that sort of thing. And like you said, pour passion into something that you're not expecting a KPI out of.
Exactly.
Yeah. Or a performance review or a paycheck.
What are your biggest challenges today? Where you're at right now?
Challenges professionally, we're growing, and whilst that's, I always think it's, I tell my team it's much more exciting working for a growing company that is a static or shrinking one. I'm not sure they believe me. but they all have challenges. They're just different ones. So that's a challenge, is the culture changes as you grow. And, I don't know. We hire people I've never met now, and I don't know everyone who works for me, whereas like 10 years ago I did. So that's a challenge in itself, in terms of culture becomes something that you're kind of not really that involved in, because it has its own culture and they set the culture. And that's a challenge psychologically and just professionally, seeing that kind of happen. And it's exciting, but it's definitely something that needs far more kind of direct input from dedicated resources than it doesn't happen, by accident. So I think recognizing that is going to be a huge challenge. I think personally, for me, it's a personal development piece. Like, I obviously want to be really good at what I do. I want to be a really good leader. And I know that I have skills gaps in myself personally. And it's identifying those, working on them, getting into rooms where I feel stupid again, and making sure that I'm doing the personal development to go along with it at the right pace. I think that's going to be the huge challenge over the next few years.
So when you say bring in dedicated resource mm-hmm. people, you mean hiring someone specifically to look after that side of the business?
Yeah, so for the first time, we're hiring kind of under that people and culture umbrella. Mm-hmm. So
you dedicated, instead of using kind of outsourced companies, dedicated in-house people and culture people to kind of, you look after the teams and make sure you all the right admin and the various legal stuff is done, but actually to kind of build, set, maintain, monitor culture within Mazooma. And that's a big step because we're at coming up for 50-ish people now, I think, 40-something. And it's getting its own momentum. And I think it's important that we have that for people. And it's they're not there for me. They're there for the rest of the team. And I'm very conscious that I'm sort of hiring somebody who I probably won't like a lot of what they say a lot of the time. Like, I'm going to have to take their advice.
Yeah.
They're going to be disruptive for me.
Yeah.
But that's a really good thing, I think.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. People, in a service-based business, it's like an extra layer of hard because when you bring people into a business, it's always the most complex thing because you're just layering every time you bring in a new human being. People think you hire someone and it makes your life easier.
No,
it doesn't. It's the complete opposite. You bring in a new layer of emotions, complex subjectivity, everything else that comes along with a human being. And people don't seem to understand that. So then with a service-based business, where in order to grow, you have to grow the number of people, there must be just like such a huge layer of complexity.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, it's people dealing with people.
Yeah.
So our clients are people too, with their own backgrounds, histories, you know, nuances. It's the people piece is huge, and the right people is amazing. So when you get a group of people, you know, like you have those days when everyone like clicks and gels and everything seems to be really easy. That's when you get that really right mix of people, that kind of really gelled set of people. That kind of bad apple kind of analogy is so true in organizational cultures, where all it takes is for kind of one person to bring that tone down, someone else be having a bad day to kind of get sucked into it, someone else to come in and be coming with the wrong attitude, and suddenly you've got a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really hard to solve. And you can't really go up to somebody and go, you've got a really bad attitude and I don't like it, fix it. Because that's, you know, without meaning to sound too cheesy, for whatever reason, that's their truth. Like, they don't like something for whatever reason. You have to go and investigate that, deal with it, drill down into it. It's where the hiring piece really comes in. Like, what does your recruitment process look like? Are you making sure that you're filtering through the right people, attracting the right people in? And it's something we've not always got right. You know, we've had people leave us over the years who weren't a good fit. The other challenge we've got when it comes to people is that who we are as an organization is very different to who we were as an organization 17 years ago, when it was just me and Sophie and one laptop between us in a spare bedroom, versus where we are now, or even 5 years ago. You know, the development of technology, the pace at which we work, the type of reporting we do, client demands are different. You know, in a post-social media world where everyone wants things instantly and everyone's got a very instant gratification mindset, it's much harder to deliver amazing customer service when, you know, a couple of years ago, a one working day turnaround in emails was acceptable. Now, if you're not on it in 2 hours, you're getting a follow-up going, did you get my email?
Yeah.
You know, expectations have changed as well. And so what goes along with that is a cultural shift in your company. And you have to make sure that you've got the right people on the bus. And some people, that's been actually one of the hardest things, is seeing long-standing members of staff who have come along with us on the journey so far, and they've reached their stop and they have to get off now because they don't want to go the rest of the journey. That's really hard. And that can feel a little bit heartbreaking.
Yeah.
To see that happen. And you know they're doing it for the right reasons, and they're doing it for themselves, which they have to do for their own development. But that can also feel really heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Because they came so far with you. And you're like, oh, you could just do another couple more years. You got all the big ideas you've got, you'll see it. And they're like, nope, this is my stop.
Yeah.
This is where I get off the bus. And you have to respect that, but it's hard. So that's a huge challenge when you're growing a company, because some people will be with you all the way, some people will be there three quarters of the way, some people will have got on the wrong bus entirely.
Yeah.
And you just need to get them off. Yeah. But yeah, it's the people piece.
What does the future hold? Anything exciting?
I hope loads of exciting stuff. I mean, it's always exciting, isn't it? Because we're always trying to do something differently. And we're doing a bit of work at the moment into like what our core values are, and we're doing that piece again, you know, that kind of culture piece. So seeing that fed back to me by other people is quite exciting. Yeah. One of my team had pulled it together and sent it over to me, and I read this presentation. And I got goosebumps because I was like, oh, like this is what we are, but I didn't come up with it. Like that's really exciting that other people came to me and like reflected that back. That was really cool. We're obviously developing our technology, which is the engine behind what we do in terms of the efficiency piece. Like that's working really well. The adoption, that's really good. And then the company's growing. So just seeing what that's going to look like and what that brings, I'm certain there's going to be challenges and opportunities that I won't have even thought of that appear. But I just hope that I've got enough in my wheelhouse to face them head on and see what it brings. But yeah, I'm always really, I'm quite a kind of, despite the raging anxiety, I'm quite an optimistic person. Like I'm always quite optimistic that there's always good opportunity out there. So I'm just generally always excited about what that's going to be and what it's going to look like and then who I'm going to be at the end of it.
It's amazing. I can see you were in like top 10, top 4.
That'd be nice.
Yeah.
Let's say that. I'll put that on my little chart now. Like, right.
Put on your vision book.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, like having those things to aim for, I think is like super cool. But, you know, our thing has always been, look, we've taken a profession that at the time I entered it was really stale and was ripe for change. And we've fought so hard along the way to get those changes and to see them take foothold and to see other people start adopting them, see other people use language we used right at the beginning as if it's always existed, to see people talk to me about a subscription not realizing that we invented it. That's like kind of cool. People are like, oh yeah, we decided to do this model because I've researched it and this is one of the great models. In fact, one time that I kind of realized, you know, these little moments where you think, oh, like maybe I've made it. One of my cousins, when he was doing his GCSE business, and he sent me a copy of the GCSE paper. So it was the Welsh exam board, and they'd used Mazuma as an example in the exam paper.
Wow.
Of a disruptive company. I've got that on my phone somewhere. And that I was like, oh my goodness, like we're now academic, like we're now being used as a case study.
We're legit.
Yeah,
we're legit.
Like, some way to tell us we're legit.
yeah.
And I was like, that's really cool to have it like reflected back to you. Is quite a moment, and that's what we want to keep doing.
Oh, it's amazing. Well, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for letting me ramble for however long this has been.
I'm sure it's been so super useful, and yeah, it's just amazing to see you. I'm sure we will see you up on that stage again, winning more awards and just doing more.
Or giving them out to other people, like reach a hand back.
Yeah,
I can't wait to see what the next generation does as well. So yeah, I'm here for them.
Nice. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.